conduct. Some of the members wanted to impeach him for bombing Cambodia or impounding federal funds. The whole process was outrageous, the president said. In a court proceeding, a jury would get no evidence at all if the prosecutor were to conduct an investigation without limits or if he failed to define the charges. St. Clair had observed that the committee's position had left some room to maneuver. The president explained how he proposed to take advantage of the crawl space, however narrow. The tests of his conduct in Watergate were his actions, not the discussions leading up to them, nor the alternatives he had considered before acting. Buzhardt nodded his agreement, and Nixon continued. A president confronted with allegations that his top aides were involved in obstruction of justice had no choice but to examine every option. Some of them might sound bad. What mattered, however, was the final decision. And his final decision had been always to let the investigations go forward. That was, after all, what St. Clair was resting the greater part of his case on. The deleted material was irrelevant to his actions. He had merely been thinking aloud, feeling out the situation, testing his aides, examining the options. Nothing related to his own actions had been deleted from the transcripts of the tapes. The president's solution was simple. He would simply insert an appropriate phrase where he had made cuts. Materials unrelated to presidential actions deleted. The burden was off the lawyers and on his shoulders, he told Buzhardt. Buzhardt wasn't exactly sure what the phrase meant, but he understood the concept. It was certainly grasping at straws, he thought, but it might work. It was unethical for a lawyer to represent material as not relevant when in fact it was. Still, Buzhardt told himself, the client could claim what he wished. Buzhardt, St. Clair, and Haig talked it over again. The president clearly wanted to delete material that was relevant. Still, they decided, they had an obligation to look at the larger picture. Something had to be turned over to the committee if the president were to stand a chance. Something was better than nothing. The president continued his work. Buzhardt and Haig began to look for a lever to get him to agree to fewer cuts. Once the committee saw all those materials unrelated ... they realized, the effect might be almost as bad as if they had submitted nothing. Once again they went to the president. Some process of verification would have to be proposed by the White House to make the transcripts believable. That had almost worked with the Stennis Compromise the previous fall. Why not allow Rodino and Representative Edward Hutchinson, the ranking minority members of the committee, to come to the White House and listen to the tapes? The president seemed worried. Will they come right away? He asked. Buzhardt assured him that the process would take months, if indeed they ever came at all. It was likely that they would refuse on the grounds that only their staff counsel had the necessary expertise to make a careful review of the material. But the threat gave Haig and Buzhardt a lever to use on the president. If you cut this, they started saying, and if Rodino and Hutchinson come down and find it, it will be three times as bad. Still, the president wanted to cut more. He refused to provide any transcripts from before March 21, 1973, the date he claimed he had first learned of the cover-up from Dean. Buzhardt reminded him that Dorr, Rodino, and Minority Counsel Jenner had been insistent about getting the March 17th conversation with Dean. Moreover, the president had an incentive to provide them with a portion of that conversation. He had asserted that March 17th was when he had first learned of the break-in into the office of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist. The tape supported his claim, probably proved it. The president decided to supply the committee with a four-page segment of the 45-minute conversation, the part in which he said of the Ellsberg burglary, "This is the first I ever heard of this." He refused to provide the portion of the conversation that dealt with the Watergate cover-up. Dean had told him that the federal investigation was leading to Haldeman, and the president had replied, "We've got to cut that off. We can't have that go to Haldeman." The lawyers in Haig accepted his decision. The president also wanted to eliminate the transcript of the conversation he had had with Haldeman and Ehrlichman on the morning of April 14th. Mozart said the conversation was clearly about Watergate. There were lengthy discussions of Haldeman and Ehrlichman's culpability and of how they were to go about sacrificing Jeb Magruder, John Mitchell, and maybe Dean to save Haldeman and Ehrlichman. Disclosure of the conversation would do heavy damage to Haldeman and Ehrlichman, and the president tried to hold out, but his lawyers insisted. Finally, he agreed to include it, but with several sections deleted, including one in which he seemed to imply that he had given his personal thanks to a Republican fundraiser for coming up with cash that was used to pay the Watergate burglars for their silence. Buzzard and St. Clair were able to accept some of the additional cuts. They rationalized that many of the deletions were largely repetitive of material that had been left in. Also, they were wary of rubbing Haldeman and Ehrlichman's noses further into the Watergate grime. They didn't want to jeopardize unnecessarily the defense at the cover-up trial. It could harm the president if his two loyal former aides became angered. Haig conferred with the lawyers again to consider their double-edged strategy, how to satisfy the committee and keep Nixon from scrapping the transcripts altogether. He could see that the president was getting tired of the debate. Perhaps it would not make too much difference if a few more ambiguous references were deleted, even if they did appear to be relevant. The heavily expurgated product would have to suffice. They could live with it, unless some piece of definitive evidence against the president surfaced. They also discussed a related problem which had been deferred since December. The special prosecutor, and now the Judiciary Committee too, had copies of seven of the tapes, including the March 21st conversation between Nixon and Dean. They were going to become public, either in the cover-up trial or at some point during the committee hearings. Buzzard thought it remarkable that details had not leaked already. When a leak did occur, or when the facts were disclosed in a trial or a hearing, they would become public in the most unfavorable context. So Buzzard argued that the edited transcripts should be released now by the White House, and St. Clair agreed. If the material were put out in a single huge block consisting of hundreds of pages, many of the damaging parts would be submerged. The most damning parts, which could not stay submerged, would draw less attention as part of a huge package than if they were to trickle out line by line over the weeks and months. It was the same argument Pat Buchanan had advanced in December. The lawyers took the proposal to the president. "We've got to make this all public," Buzzard said. "Public release would give the president the edge. It would be his act of disclosure." Nixon liked the idea. It was an act which he saw as fitting his style, dramatic and bold. The public would see once and for all that he had nothing to hide. He would show the worst, and it would prove him innocent. St. Clair was beginning to feel enthusiastic about the idea. Now he was starting to understand why people stuck with Richard Nixon through tribulation. As difficult as the president had made his life over the past few months, there were certain things about the man he had come to admire. Nixon was willing to spread out all of this material before the committee, and now he had agreed to let the public listen in on his most private discussions. That took real courage, St. Clair thought. It was clear that the president's image would suffer. But that was exactly what would lend the transcripts their stamp of authenticity. St. Clair read through the ones that were ready. He would have to face up to the shabby language. There were so many ambiguous references, so many overtones of conspiracy. A large part of the public had already made up its mind that the president was guilty. The odds seemed to be shifting heavily against Nixon. But St. Clair thought he knew how to reverse them. He had focused his case on a single pivot. The president claimed to have learned of the cover-up on March 21, 1973. The indictment charged that the last payment of hush money to Hunt had been made on March 21. If St. Clair could convince the House Judiciary Committee that the president had not in fact learned of the cover-up until that day, then the president could not have been involved in obstructing justice. The president was the devil's advocate on March 21st, probing Dean, thinking out loud, perhaps leading Dean on, The president's actions after March 21st were all designed to bring out the facts. Some of the transcripts contained the support for the chronology St. Clair needed. He started to piece it together. But one problem remained. The conversation of September 15, 1972, in which the president threatened to fire the chief of the IRS and George Shultz. He didn't get to be Secretary of the Treasury because he has nice blue eyes. Buzzard had maneuvered successfully in November to claim that the passage was unrelated to Watergate. Oddly enough, the sleight of hand had worked. Sirica had withheld the conversation from the prosecutor. Buzzard and Haig had been lucky. Once. They were doubtful that they could get away with it again. The risks were higher this time. There was no way they could claim that the conversation was unrelated to the committee's inquiry. It was clearly more pertinent to the committee's impeachment investigation than to Jaworski's criminal inquiry. It was definitive evidence of misuse of power, which was exactly what the impeachment process was constitutionally intended to remedy. Haig and the lawyers weighed the alternatives. To include that part of the conversation was to court impeachment, and to withhold it was perhaps even more dangerous. If Hutchinson or Rodino eventually obtained it, the injury would probably be fatal. To avoid the issue by withholding all transcripts prior to March 21st would leave the president vulnerable on the Ellsberg charge and support the notion that the cover-up was continuing even now. The committee already had a copy of the September 15th tape, sanitized cooperatively by Sirica. Withholding the pre-March 21st transcripts, with non-offensive portions of the September 15th tape already in the committee's possession, would make it clear to all that the president had something to hide. Haig and the lawyers saw only one acceptable choice. They would try the same ploy, release only the segment that related specifically to Watergate. But when they took their recommendation to the president, he came down on every side of the issue, moving back and forth, vacillating between unpleasant alternatives, wondering again whether he should tell the committee to go to hell or whether he should give them only the transcripts from March 21st on. Finally, he decided that the lawyers and Haig were right. They had to try the same trick that had fooled Sirica before. Still, Nixon emphasized to them, he might yet change his mind and choose to release nothing. He was under heavy pressure from Ziegler to do just that. Even with all the deletions, Ziegler was fearful that the transcripts would bring them down. He was still arguing that the president had been merely thinking aloud, and that the transcripts would unfairly make it seem as if he had been participating in a crime. The committee and the public would form a dangerous and incorrect impression of the president's role. Haig and Buzzard were afraid that Ziegler would prevail with the president, that Nixon either would throw out much of the material they had persuaded him to include, or would decide to provide nothing. They needed to get Ziegler off their backs. The general and the counsel decided to stage a piece of theater for his benefit. The scenario was played out in Haig's office. As Ziegler watched approvingly, Haig blasted Buzzard and St. Clair. He accused them of interfering too goddamn much in the president's business. "The president will make these decisions about what to release, and not some damn lawyers," he shouted. Ziegler nodded in encouragement. That was Buzzard's cue. "Neither St. Clair nor he nor any lawyer, in fact, could stand for these deletions," he said. "Though they worked for the White House, they were bound by legal ethics. Those ethics required that they certify that the president was making full disclosure consistent with the national interest. They must insist that the president's decisions be made on the basis of law, not public relations. The transcripts, as they now stood, demonstrated the president's innocence. The lawyers had already done everything that could be expected of them. Rather more, in fact. They had compromised themselves, and what was done, but no more." Buzzard allowed Ziegler to form the impression that the president might find himself without lawyers unless he relented. Haig feigned exasperation. Buzzard's position gave him no choice, he said. There would be no more deletions. Ziegler backed off for the moment. Clearly, Haig was doing all he could. Chapter 11. On Monday, April 22nd, St. Clair called John Doerr and asked for a 5-day extension of the April 25th deadline set in the committee's subpoena. Doerr asked why the White House could not at least hand over what was ready. It would demonstrate the president's good faith. St. Clair gave no hint that the White House was preparing to turn over transcripts rather than tapes. The president wished to finish his review of all the material before anything was turned over, he explained. Doerr talked to Rodino and called St. Clair back. He would recommend the extension to the committee, Doerr said, but the committee would not be able to meet until the 25th to consider his request. On the evening of April 24th, Haig was nervous about what the committee would do the next day. But he was even more concerned about another of the president's troubles, one that was rapidly becoming his own personal problem. Haig called his old friend from Pentagon days in the Johnson administration, Joseph Califano, a prominent Washington attorney. Could they get together for dinner? Though Califano had been counsel to the Democratic National Committee at the time of the break-in, and, with Edward Bennett Williams, represented the Washington Post, Haig had stayed in close touch with them. Over dinner at Jean-Pierre, Haig explained his problem. The Senate Watergate Committee was calling him in to answer questions about Bebe Rebozo's receipt of $100,000 from Howard Hughes. Haig needed independent legal advice. Should he answer their questions, or should he invoke executive privilege, as the president and his lawyers were urging him to do? Haig knew that the president had previously waived executive privilege for any testimony involving alleged criminal conduct. Califano cut Haig's question short. Only the president, not his aides, could invoke executive privilege. He suggested that Haig position himself between the Watergate Committee and Nixon. If the president wanted executive privilege for Haig, make him ask for it by writing a letter to the committee. Haig also told Califano that the president would probably release edited transcripts to the House Judiciary Committee. Haig was sure they would vindicate the president, though the initial reaction might be negative. Califano asked his friend why he seemed so unusually troubled. Haig said he was concerned about the world situation, the unraveling in Vietnam, the Middle East. I'm concerned about the president's ability to lead in a crisis. The transcripts should help. The president is having difficulty dealing with these problems. He's distracted, spending so much time on Watergate, it's destroying his ability to lead. He's preoccupied. Califano believed his friend was holding something back. Clearly, Califano thought, Haig didn't believe Nixon was guilty of anything serious, but his manner indicated that he thought things were worse than he was willing to admit. We've got to get rid of the Watergate problem, Haig said. The next day, the 25th, the Judiciary Committee granted the president an extension until April 30th. In the White House, preparation of the transcripts continued frantically. Nixon's constant editing was making it doubtful that the deadline could be met. There wasn't time to retype all the pages, so many of them were only half-filled, and others were cut-and-paste jobs, all of which called attention to the number and length of deletions. To prevent leaks, and to keep the whole enterprise secret, the size of the group of people involved in the editing, transcribing, correcting, and photocopying had been kept small. Many of the secretaries were shocked at what the tapes revealed, and even more were shocked at the way the transcripts were being manhandled. Linda Zier was particularly upset. Why so many deletions? She asked Pamela Dallas as they left the office, exhausted late one night. Tears were streaming down Zier's face. What would happen if the originals were revealed? Ziegler, too, was upset and was again wondering aloud whether anything should be released. He thought the lawyers were still leaving in too much, and he assigned his two personal assistants, Diane Sawyer and Frank Gannon, to review the editing and report back to him. Poring over the hundreds of transcript pages, Gannon and Sawyer were dismayed at the sloppy presentation. Lines spoken by the president were mistakenly divided and attributed in part to Ehrlichman. The same expletives were sometimes left in, sometimes deleted. Harmless characterizations were eliminated, and damaging ones retained. Certain passages referred back to matters that had been excised. Such references stuck out like sore thumbs. They could not fail to convey the impression that the really damaging parts had been eliminated. As Sawyer and Gannon worked late the night of Friday the 26th, they pleaded for more time. A document that was to be used to defend a president against impeachment could not be released in this condition. The president was at Camp David, making still more deletions. Ziegler took their request to Haig. The general explained that the lawyers were firm. They had already gotten one extension from the committee. Another was out of the question. No matter how sloppy the transcripts were, or how serious the inconsistencies and inaccuracies, the transcripts would have to reach the committee on the 30th. Tensions were growing. The lawyers resented what they regarded as interference from Sawyer and Gannon. More public relations veneer. Ziegler's aides resented the lawyers' objections. More legalisms. Gannon and Sawyer returned to their proofreading and editing. It was difficult to cast the transcripts into uniform presentation. The people who had prepared them had operated under vague instructions to delete impolite or tasteless phrases, and they had had varying standards. Gannon was further troubled that such a complex series of conversations was to be released without any attempt to explain the context of the discussions or the significance of the references. There had to be some kind of concordance. Some of the references were subtle. The reader might be overwhelmed by the tone and ignore the substantive support for the president's version. The transcripts left no doubt that the president had explored almost every conceivable avenue to prevent disclosure of the truth. But it made a big difference, Gannon thought, whether that fact was understood in the context of the Senate Watergate Committee and other congressional hearings with their political overtones, or in the context of a grand jury. Without an explanatory text, every such reference would appear unfairly in the worst context. Gannon, a Ph.D., was something of an expert on James Joyce. Parts of the transcripts, with their convoluted rhetoric and almost surrealistic thoughts, reminded him of Joyce's Ulysses, streams of presidential consciousness. Gannon feared that the president's words would be as misunderstood and as misconstrued as Joyce's. He wanted to write a commentary, a key, that might unlock the meaning of the president's dialogues. Ziegler prevailed on St. Clair to let Gannon review the draft of the legal brief he was preparing and contribute suggestions. Gannon borrowed a desk in the counsel's office and read each page as St. Clair completed it. The lawyer's developing brief seemed to be a fair representation of the president's case, Gannon thought, but it was an advocate's case. Intended for experts, it built on details. There was not much attempt to explain confusing and obscure references. Yet, painfully inadequate as it was, Gannon thought, the brief demonstrated that the president had ultimately chosen the right courses of action, if sometimes rather late. The transcripts might be a public relations disaster. They might be embarrassing or humiliating, but they would show the president technically innocent of violating the law. St. Clair and Gannon agreed about that. The president wanted to announce his decision in a prime-time televised address from the Oval Office, a format he was comfortable with. Since 1969, he had delivered 35 speeches from the Oval Office on live television. The medium enabled him to appeal directly to his constituency, over the heads of a biased press. Haig thought the approach had been overused on Vietnam, and its usefulness almost totally exhausted in Watergate. In front of the cameras, Nixon exuded self-righteousness, self-justification, self-pity. Nixon on television didn't sell anymore, Haig thought. He directed Ray Price, who was going to write the speech, to get copies of the transcripts from the lawyers. Price would have to find a way to put the tapes in some acceptable context. Price did not think the conversations in their edited form established conclusively whether or not the president had broken the law. They seemed ambiguous. But that was only part of the problem. He worried about the emotional impact the transcripts were certain to elicit. They shattered the accepted mythology of the presidency, and certainly of this president. He was not shocked, however. As he read, Price jotted down some thoughts. These were tactical discussions among people who were caught in a situation each one was convinced was not of his own making, particularly the president, Price reasoned. He doubted that anyone involved in those discussions knew the whole truth, then or now. Watergate was like a hot potato, he thought. When the president realized it was in his hands, he had looked desperately for a way to get rid of it without creating a governmental crisis and bringing down his whole administration. Yes, the president was wrong at some critical junctures, Price thought. But the conversations had to be understood in the context of the presidency, of Nixon's enemies, of Nixon's aspirations for the country. Nothing was black or white ethically. The president had always weighed the effect of his actions in Watergate against the larger interests of national security, ending the war, winning the peace, keeping the government strong and functioning. Those might not be the concerns of the House Judiciary Committee or the Special Prosecutor's Office, but Price was certain they had guided the president. On Saturday, April 27th, Price flew to Camp David to work with Nixon on the speech. He had already circulated a third draft to the inner circle, Haig, Ziegler, and the lawyers. They were pleased, but they still did not know if there would be a speech. The president was continuing to examine all his options, Haig said. Price met with the president that afternoon. Nixon was editing transcripts. He seemed to be leaning toward a final decision to release them. At least, that would enable him to lay it all out from his perspective, he said, before other people laid it out from theirs. He wanted to stamp his interpretation on it. He was hopeful, Nixon said. There was little else he could do under the circumstances, but he had no illusions that releasing the transcripts would sweep everything away. Price went to his office in Sycamore Cabin and began incorporating some of the president's handwritten additions into the text. He worked late into the night, breaking only once for an hour's nap and missing that evening's movie in Laurel Lodge, Magnum Force. On Sunday, he conferred by phone several more times with the president on final revisions. Finally, he walked over to Aspen Cabin to sit and talk with Nixon in his den. It was a good speech, they agreed. Price struggled for words that did not come easily. "Mr. President, I've never admired you more than for the way you've held up under the pressure this past year." The president seemed embarrassed and uncomfortable. He acknowledged that there had been pressure. It had been immense, he said. But he could take the pressure, personally. A lot of it came from the same old crowd, those who had been out to get him for 25 years, but the pressure was keeping him from doing what he wanted to do, from doing things that were really important for the country. Price was struck by the thought of how much more important it was to have this man around than to worry about who had bugged the Democratic chairman's phone. He knew it sounded simplistic, but wasn't it really more important to prevent World War III and maybe a depression than to destroy this man for something so silly, so insignificant as Watergate? "We've got to put Watergate behind us," Nixon said. Price had heard him say the same thing many times before, but this time, the words were conveyed with more emotion than perhaps anything he had ever heard the president say. That afternoon, 200 miles to the north of Camp David, Sybil Kucharski, a young bank teller, completed her obligations as foreman of a jury in the United States Courthouse in Foley Square, New York City. At 12:57 p.m., she stood in front of the bench in an old and dark courtroom and proceeded to pronounce not guilty 18 times. Former Attorney General John N. Mitchell and former Commerce Secretary Morris H. Stans, the principal officials of the president's 1972 campaign, were acquitted on all counts in the Vesco case. "We got to the jury system, and that always works," Mitchell said. 9 minutes later, the news reached Juwan at the White House, and he called Camp David. The president was elated. It was surely the best news in more than a year. Haig and Ziegler had been briefing him daily on the case, and he had been looking for acquittals. He called Mitchell and Stans to congratulate them. Later, he talked with David Eisenhower. The agony of his subordinates was the most painful part of Watergate, he said. It was a relief that these men weren't going to jail because of their association with him. They were close friends. It felt good to be able to communicate with them again. "They are good men," the president said. The acquittals appeared to end the president's indecision about whether the transcripts should be released. He had fretted too long. It was time to act. He gave Haig the go-ahead, but not before he had solved some of his last-minute editing problems by literally throwing several pages away. As the sheer mechanics of preparing the transcripts for public consumption intensified, David Hoops, an aide in the office of the staff secretary, summoned the State Department silkscreener from a baseball game. Hoops shared the general White House concern for packaging, and he had designed a cover for the master sets of transcripts. He ordered the silkscreener to prepare black vinyl binders, two for each conversation. Each binder was to be stamped with a gold presidential seal and, just above it, a gold embossed legend. Submission of recorded presidential conversations to the Committee on the Judiciary of the House of Representatives by President Richard Nixon. They would look great on television, Hoops thought. That afternoon, Pat Buchanan got a set of the transcripts, still unbound and without the president's final expurgations, from Special Presidential Counsel Richard Moore. Buchanan had seen much of the material before, so the content did not much surprise him, but he was startled at the idea that the transcripts were to be just dumped on the press and the public without any explanatory text. The scenario he had devised last December for the release of certain transcripts had been ignored. A public relations disaster was in the making, he told Moore. Leonard Garman asked for a copy of the transcripts. His request was denied. Later in the afternoon, a dozen members of the speech writing and communication staffs gathered in the office of Ken W. Clawson, White House Director of Communications. Buzzard and St. Clair, who had arranged the meeting, were delayed, so Clawson passed out copies of the 40-page brief that St. Clair had prepared for submission to the Judiciary Committee. The document quoted extensively from portions of the transcripts which tended to support the president's version of events. The brief was essentially a savage attack on John Dean, taking what advantage it could of his rare memory lapses before the Watergate committee. Clawson was buoyant, partly because of the Mitchell-Stans verdict and partly as a result of what the president's lawyers had told him. The end of Watergate was finally at hand, he assured his colleagues. The transcripts would win the day. He referred to the president's speech. Watergate is going to go away tomorrow, he assured them. Speechwriter Ben Stein, a Yale Law School graduate and the son of Nixon's chief economic advisor, Herbert Stein, was dubious. You don't really believe that, Ken, do you? His tone was contemptuous. Stein had worked too long on the defense to take the lawyers or Clawson seriously. Clawson ignored him. I want you to go back to your offices and write speeches for our congressmen based on St. Clair's brief. Say the president is innocent, and it's finally been proven. The speechwriters would get transcripts later. All they needed at present was the brief. Stein exchanged skeptical looks with David Gergen, a tall Harvard law graduate who ran the White House speechwriting staff. Knowing the lawyers, I sure hate to rely on this kind of summary for that kind of statement, Stein said. Gergen agreed. Buzzard and St. Clair had not yet arrived. They waited a few more minutes, and then Clawson recessed the meeting. Write your little speeches, and then we'll regroup later, he said. At about 6 p.m., the group filed into Clawson's office again to watch televised accounts of the Mitchell-Stans acquittal. The verdict seemed to support the White House claim that Watergate was an obsession limited to Washington and the news media. The people, the real people, didn't much care about Watergate. They didn't find it so serious. Even in sophisticated New York City, the headquarters of the Eastern liberal establishment, a jury of 12 men and women had voted not guilty on all charges. But beyond temporary morale boosting, and not a little gloating, the news had even more serious and more encouraging implications. John Dean had been a key prosecution witness, and apparently the jury had not believed him. Now, we should have the Attorney General ask the special prosecutor why perjury charges aren't being brought against John Dean, suggested Kenneth Kechagian, an aide to Buchanan. Clausen announced that St. Clair and Buzzart would arrive at any moment. Stein was struck by Clausen's tone. It approached reverence.
You would think we were waiting for the Wizard of Oz, he said to Gergen.
The lawyers at last joined the group around the large round conference table. In contrast to the informality of the staffers' Sunday sports clothes, they wore dark business suits. St. Clair took off his coat and began talking about the light at the end of the tunnel. His enthusiasm was boundless as he reiterated Clausen's theme. You can write something saying that the end of Watergate is near. The tapes would prove John Dean a liar. Clausen hung on every word. He nodded encouragement. Then Buzzart spoke briefly, but no less optimistically. Stein and Gergen were dumbstruck. Neither Clausen, nor Buzzart, nor St. Clair had offered anything specific. How was this miraculous turn of events to come to pass? It was a pep rally. Clichés, cheers, exhortations. Stein rose. Do you really think that this is the end? He was facing St. Clair, his voice dripping sarcasm. Clausen glared at Stein, as if he were crazy to ask the question. Stein thought the meeting had taken on a lunatic quality.
There will be several rough days, St. Clair said. But a careful examination of the transcripts will convince people we're right. We're definitely out of the woods.
Gergen shook his head. He was wondering why the tapes had been withheld for almost a year if they were finally going to end Watergate. Haig called a cabinet meeting for Monday evening, April 29th. As the cabinet members arrived, they passed the Oval Office furniture, which had been moved into the hallway to make room for the television crew that was setting up for the president's speech an hour later. They took their places in the high-backed brown leather chairs around the 20-foot oval table. The president had bought the table and had said he would leave it to the White House when he left office. The president's chair was empty. Vice President Ford was the ranking official in the room. Finally, the president's chief of staff marched in. This was Haig's meeting. The room was quiet. Haig, deadly serious, began. There were 1,254 pages of transcripts that were going to be released the next day. They would make for a rough several days. The president's language was often coarse. It's the kind of language you probably used in your office this morning, Haig told them. Then, finished with the bad news, he turned to the good news. The transcripts would put Watergate behind them. He turned the meeting over to St. Clair, who outlined the basic points of his brief. To the junior staff aides seated on the side of the room, the cabinet meeting sounded like the same pep rally they had attended in Clausen's office the evening before. Haig described how difficult the transcribing process had been, a tedious, almost impossible assignment because of the poor quality of the recordings. I have purposefully not listened to the tapes because I take the president personally at his word, Haig continued. But he wanted them to understand the immense technical problems the transcribers and lawyers had been confronted with. Buzzart, sitting at the side of the room beside a tape recorder, got his cue from Haig. They were going to play a portion of one of the clearer tapes, Haig announced, though this was not true. It was not one of the clearer tapes. Some of the cabinet members could distinguish the president's voice, but the words were almost unintelligible. Buzzart let the tape run for a minute or so to dramatize the problem. Buzzart and Haig wanted a whole cabinet of witnesses who could attest to the bad quality of the tapes. It might help them get by all the questions they were certain to be asked about the shortcomings of the transcripts. Now Haig raised a troublesome point. Some cabinet members were defending the president vigorously. Earl L. Butts of Agriculture, Roger C. B. Morton of Interior, and Frederick B. Dent of Commerce were doing a splendid job, but others were oddly quiet. Haig hoped that now, with evidence from the tapes to support them, they all would go out and proclaim the president's innocence. A few minutes before 9 p.m., the president walked into the Oval Office and went to a side table on which the gold-embossed transcript binders were stacked side by side for the cameras. Some of them contained only a single page of transcript. Nixon picked up one binder, opened it for a second, and, with a look of disbelief and a slight shake of his head, threw it back. Then he sat down behind the big desk and waited for the television technicians to check their lighting and camera positions. As the president waited to deliver his speech, Buzhardt called the lawyers for Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and Mitchell to tell them what was coming.
"Is it going to do my client any damage?"
asked John J. Wilson, Haldeman's attorney.
"Yes," Buzhardt answered.
"What the hell is the president going to do that for? Did you recommend it?"
Buzhardt did not reply. Wilson grunted. He didn't like it, but he understood. At 45 seconds past 9 p.m., the president began.
"In these transcripts, portions not relevant to my knowledge or actions with regard to Watergate are not included, but everything that is relevant is included, the rough as well as the smooth," he said.
Holding the pages of the 14th draft of his speech, he referred to the strategy session, the explorations of alternatives, the weighing of human and political costs laid out in the transcripts. "These materials, together with those already made available, will tell it all." By providing transcripts instead of the tapes, he was at once protecting the principle of presidential confidentiality and enabling the Congress to meet its constitutional responsibilities. The impeachment of a president was a remedy of last resort, which would put the nation through a wrenching ordeal. The impact of such an ordeal would be felt throughout the world, and it would have its effect on the lives of all Americans for many years to come. Because this is an issue that profoundly affects all the American people, in addition to turning over these transcripts to the House Judiciary Committee, I have directed that they should all be made public. The camera panned across the room to the two stacks. "All of these that you see here. They will at last once and for all show that what I knew and what I did with regard to the Watergate break-in and cover-up were just as I have described them to you from the beginning. In giving you these, blemishes and all, I am placing my trust in the basic fairness of the American people." The president did not provide the transcripts that evening. He wanted the speech to be considered in its own context. Even Nixon's most severe critics thought the speech a very good one, at the least artfully constructed. The admissions he had made in the address, "I several times suggested that meeting Hunt's demands might be necessary," seemed to make his broader claim of innocence more believable. The speech was less strident than usual, and less self-serving. The White House gathered an 8-page summary of favorable reaction to the speech. The most encouraging signs came from key Republicans on the Hill. Senate Minority Leader Hugh Scott welcomed as evidence of good faith the wealth of material which the president was forwarding to the House committee. Senator Robert P. Griffin, Republican whip, said, "It was an effective presentation by a confident president." Senator Barry Goldwater said the offer of the transcripts was both fair and reasonable, and should be sufficient unless the House committee was engaged in a fishing expedition. House Minority Leader John J. Rhodes said the plan sounds logical to me. Vice President Ford said, "The president is giving the Judiciary Committee more than enough information with which to carry out its investigation. I think the president is being more than cooperative." Such statements were exactly what the White House had hoped for, the kind of reaction which would undercut protests from the House Judiciary Committee. Any further demands from the committee would seem like harassment. On the next morning, April 30th, a White House station wagon carried unbound copies of the transcripts to Capitol Hill, one set for each of the members of the House Judiciary Committee and the leaders of both parties. At the government printing office, sets of transcripts were being bound in bulky, 3-inch-thick volumes with blue covers. As the first copies were being bound, Ziegler and Clausen put their plan into action. They canceled the morning press briefing and arranged for the reporters to receive St. Clair's brief, but not the transcripts, in the early afternoon. Thus, the afternoon papers would have only the White House interpretation of the transcripts. The press office announced that the transcripts would be arriving as soon as they left the GPO presses. But several unbound copies were already circulating among the staff. Gergen had gotten hold of one the night before and had stayed up reading in his office until 3 a.m. The next morning, he approached Ben Stein, who was working on a housing statement. "The moral authority of the president is collapsing," Gergen said. "How can you be thinking about housing?" When the bound transcripts arrived from the GPO, Buzzard and St. Clair autographed copies for the secretaries. Buzzard got 250 copies and sent them to his friends and former colleagues at the Pentagon. The 200,000 words of edited transcripts were finally given to the press about 2 hours before the network's evening newscasts. Ziegler had hoped that the reporters wouldn't have enough time to locate the material that would undermine St. Clair's brief. But they lost no time in getting to the March 21st transcript. "You have no choice but to come up with the $120,000. Keep the cap on the bottle. Buy time. Tough it through." The evening newscasts were filled with these remarks, and as well with the coarser side of President Nixon. "I want the most comprehensive notes on all those who tried to do us in. They are asking for it, and they are going to get it. Have you kicked a few butts around?" The transcripts would provide grist for many sensational stories in the press, the president had said in his speech. He was right. The Chicago Tribune reprinted the transcripts verbatim in a special section. Two paperback book editions of the released script were rushed into print, and they sold millions. Radio and television network broadcasts offered readings in which newsmen and actors dramatized the parts of the president, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and Dean. Ziegler complained. The actors attached twists and inflections to the words. Jokes about deleted expletives made the rounds. There seemed to be no end. Ken Clawson, meanwhile, was distributing to White House aides a list of all the radio talk shows in major cities. A covering memorandum suggested that members of the White House staff phone the stations and state the president's case. Instead of picking up a phone, Dave Gergen picked up his pen and scribbled a note to Haig's aide, Julwan. "Is there no way to bring these circulars under control? Many people over here find some of them offensive, others dangerous if they ever reach the press, and a few, like this one, unethical if not illegal. Does anyone really think taxpayers pay for government lines in order to have White House staffers call radio talk shows?" On Wednesday afternoon, May 1st, the Judiciary Committee voted almost exactly along party lines, 20-18, to inform the president that the transcripts did not satisfy the subpoena. Haig told the senior staff that if Republican support held, the committee would have to proceed without the tapes. The president's strategy appeared to be working. It was doubtful that an attempt to cite him for contempt could succeed. "As long as the committee remained divided along partisan lines," Haig said, "the president was protected." By the close of that business day, the government printing office had sold out its entire first printing of the transcripts. The president sent one copy to David and Julie Eisenhower's home. Julie didn't want to read it, but David stayed up nights reading that week. The president's family was upset by his decision to concede the transcripts. The cold, printed words they felt in no way conveyed the president's hurt and concern during those awful months in 1973, the fear for his aides' futures, for his administration. The transcripts made Nixon out to be cynical, petty, selfish. The family knew otherwise. They thought, just as he did, that his enemies would use the transcripts to tear him apart. If his enemies couldn't find anything much in the substance, Nixon had said, they would use the shadow. David Eisenhower knew how the president talked in private, and he knew equally well that there was no way the transcripts could hide it, even with all the expletives deleted. The idiom of the White House under Nixon was hard-nosed and brutal. It had been that way in David's grandfather's day. He assured Nixon that language and tone were sham issues. David was more concerned about the president's muddling approach to things and his indecision.
The transcripts had surprised him, and he felt both relief and foreboding. They seemed to establish that the president had no advance knowledge of the Watergate break-in and espionage. But they had also shown David a president who was careless, amoral, and unclear in his own mind. David wondered about his father-in-law. If Watergate had been handled that way, what about other things? Leonard Garment looked at the problem of the tapes in dramatic terms. He could not understand why Nixon hadn't destroyed them before their existence was publicly revealed. If Shakespeare had written this, Garment observed, or Pirandello, or Pinter, or even Mickey Spillane, it would be essential that Nixon undertake, but fail in, an attempt at their destruction, that he be tripped by a Secret Service agent as he ran to the incinerator, or that he be apprehended as his bathrobe caught in the door. That would at least lend authority to the drama. But for the president first to record the evidence of his own shabby complicity and then to preserve the tapes was an act of transcendental lunacy, Garment thought. On Garment's stage, life was a process of being better than the worst side of oneself. But Nixon, he said, had a peculiar monster perched on his shoulder that whispered into his ear and onto his tapes. With the release of the transcripts, Nixon had allowed America into the ugliness of his mind, as if he wanted the world to participate in the despoliation of the myth of presidential behavior. The transcripts, Garment thought, were an invasion of the public's privacy, of its right not to know. That was the truly impeachable offense. Letting everyone see.
Chapter 12. On Friday, May 3rd, the president took his flight to Phoenix, Arizona. Goldwater, Rhodes, and the rest of the state's Republican congressional delegation accompanied him on Air Force One. Goldwater had guaranteed a warm reception and a campaign-style rally for the evening. The senator wore his old Air Force flight jacket as he sat making small talk with his colleague, Senator Paul J. Fannin, and Mrs. Nixon. After about an hour, the president asked the senators to join him in his private cabin for a drink. What should he talk about at the rally? Inflation seemed to be what most people were concerned about, Nixon said. Goldwater agreed, thinking that if he replied, "Mr. President, what about Watergate?" Nixon might call the Secret Service and have him thrown out of the plane. More than a year before, Goldwater had told the president that something about the Watergate affair smelled and that it should be aired, and he had offered his help. The president had acknowledged the offer perfunctorily. In any case, Goldwater was loyal to the party. He stood ready still to rally public support for the president. Nixon decided that he would talk about inflation. Goldwater and Fannin returned to their seats in the VIP compartment and played gin rummy. Rhodes was summoned forward. Nixon talked to him about Arizona, next fall's elections, legislation. The president asked about Rhodes's children. Rhodes mentioned that his son Tom had recently graduated from law school and was having difficulty with the bar exam. "Where is he now?" the president asked. "He was in Phoenix and would be meeting the plane." There was no mention of Watergate. Rhodes was relieved. He, too, had broached the subject with the president several months before. Nixon had seemed only casually interested, as Rhodes described how the House intended to conduct its impeachment inquiry. "When do you think it will be over, John?" the president had asked, as if he were not involved. "It might be over in June." "June, not before that." The president had seemed puzzled that it would take as long as 6 months. Rhodes returned to the VIP cabin after 10 minutes with Nixon. Later, the president joined the delegation in the rear, chatting easily. Congressman John B. Conlon mentioned how much he loathed the federally funded legal services project on the Navajo reservation in his district. The president needed more control over the legal services program. Nixon listened and agreed. The president shifted the topic. "He was finally over the hump," he said simply. The reference required no further explanation. The plane landed at the Arizona Air National Guard Center. It was a closed arrival, no crowds. The president was introduced to Tom Rhodes. Nixon put his arm around the young man.
"Bar examinations aren't everything," he said.
The president was smiling.
"You can come back."
The presidential motorcade ended at the Camelback Inn, where the president was to stay in the condominium of J. Willard Marriott, owner of the resort and of the restaurant Hotel Empire, which bears his name. Guests at the inn, many dressed in tennis clothes or bathing suits, lined the 200 yards from the parking lot to the president's quarters. A mariachi band of 28 high school students in orange and black uniforms and sombreros played Mexican music. The president listened, trying his best to look enchanted. He started forward to say something and shake hands with some of the musicians, but the band played on. He tried again, but the band was still playing. Finally, they stopped. He thanked them and walked the last 50 yards to the house, passing a large cactus dressed in an Uncle Sam outfit. When Goldwater had promised a warm welcome, he had not anticipated the jeering demonstrators who were waiting to greet the president at the Phoenix Coliseum. The possibility of a confrontation lasted only until the Secret Service agent in charge at the rally found another entrance. The rally was a central element in the president's newly designed effort to put Watergate behind him. It had been planned as minutely as the most important campaign appearances the president had made in 1972. The Republican National Committee had put up $20,000 to ensure the rally's success. The White House chief of advance, William Henkel, had worked hard. His lead advance man, Red Cavaney, had spent 8 days making the arrangements. Worried that the indoor coliseum, which seats 13,800, would only be half-filled, the advance team had planned to distribute an extra 10,000 tickets and then turn away the overflow at the door. Local Republicans, more concerned about disappointing bona fide ticket holders, had vetoed the idea and promised a packed hall. The president's arrival was well coordinated. A cue was given to the platform speaker, who concluded his remarks. "Hail to the chief" lasted 28 seconds. The Tucson lawyer, who had volunteered as the local advance man, signaled, and 3,000 balloons and 500 pounds of confetti descended from the rafters onto the cheering crowd. The audience stomped on the balloons, bang, 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 and roared its delight. The president mounted onto the stage. Framed by two carnation-covered styrofoam elephants, he waved his victory sign. The crowd was on its feet now, and it took several minutes before there was quiet. Then, as the president started to speak, 150 demonstrators began chanting, "Out now! Out now!" The White House communications crew turned up the volume on the speakers nearest the demonstrators and drowned them out. The president asked the dissidents to observe the tradition of free speech. Barry Goldwater half suspected that Nixon's advance team had arranged the demonstration. Once, he had heard, the president suggested to Senator James L. Buckley of New York that he stage a demonstration against himself in which he would be physically threatened. In his single mention of Watergate, the president said, "The time has come to get Watergate behind us and get on with the business of America." He pledged to stay on the job. That earned him a thunderous ovation. The edited transcripts were wholly unacceptable evidence as far as Jaworski was concerned. He wanted the president's tapes, and he thought he had a lever to get them. In the first week of May, the special prosecutor had called a meeting of his most trusted assistants. For more than 2 months, they had been sitting on probably the biggest secret in Washington, that the grand jury had voted to name the president as an unindicted co-conspirator in the plot to obstruct justice. Now, Jaworski said, the time had come to use whatever means were at their disposal to get the tapes they needed. When the White House moved to quash the prosecutor's subpoena, it had left them no alternative. Jaworski did not need to be more explicit. They were all lawyers. They knew that the ultimate legal argument in favor of the subpoena was the secret action of the grand jury. The courts had firmly established the principle that an unindicted co-conspirator must provide subpoenaed evidence.
Jaworski outlined his strategy. The House Judiciary Committee was ready to begin formal hearings on impeachment, and disclosure of the grand jury's action would devastate Nixon's position. 23 ordinary citizens had found probable cause to charge the president with participation in a crime. If that information were known, it would make it far easier for members of the Judiciary Committee, especially the Republicans and the conservative Democrats, to support impeachment. Jaworski reasoned that the most effective way to get the tapes they wanted might lie in revealing the information not in open court, but in the White House. He was ready to bargain. The staff discussed the plan. Perhaps they could do with fewer than the 64 tapes, one of the lawyers suggested, maybe 10 or 15. A compromise might be submitted to the White House in secret. Exactly, said Jaworski. Haig was traveling with the president when Jaworski reached him by phone. Alec, I need to talk to you. In private. Jaworski suggested May 5th, the next Sunday, at the White House.